Sean, how's it going?
Hello? Yes?
Can you hear me now?
Hey, Matt, how are you?
Great.
I can.
All right. We have, we've changed his nickname tonight. He used to be the psychic. Tonight he's the anchorman, Tom Padgett.
How you doing, Sean?
Hey, Tom, how are you, Matt? Thank you for having me on the program.
Oh, man, last time, that show's been listened to a lot. The old history, UFC 1, One Glove Jimerson. A lot of stuff.
That's exactly right.
You know, like Rich was saying, we just had such a fun time talking, so we'll keep it a little more serious tonight, maybe. But, that was a great time.
I appreciate that. We can talk UFC 1, we can talk the Great Art Davey, talk PKFC, talk whatever you like.
You know, and it's just exciting, and look at what you're doing now. And this could be the verge of something new here, too. You know, I've got a few suggestions, you know, but right now, hey, this is exciting as well. So let's just have some fun.
Most definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I'm having the time of my life at PKFC and Thriller, and now they come together, which is extremely cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, now, Sean, last time we talked, you were doing some work for Bellator. So, I mean, it's just worlds apart from where you are now, from what I've seen. You've been so busy doing all these events. And you've seen really an evolution, from what I can see, of what happens to fighters after they get out of the UFC. And in the case of this triad combat thing, you know, what happens when you throw boxers in a situation with MMA fighters. And you put a theme around it. So just kind of give us that perspective of, like, what you've seen in that different realm from what you've been used to.
Yeah, it's an evolution. I was with Bellator for 5.5 years, so when we talked, when I was promoting my book, Is This Legal with Art Davey, which, by the way, is going to be made into a movie, which I'm happy to about and really proud to mention.
Awesome.
But, yeah, I was in the midst of my Bellator run. And the industry continues to change. You know, promotions come, promotions go. I think that's the nature of it. First and foremost, I'm an advocate for fighters. So when fighters have more opportunity to get paid, to enter legitimate free agency with real choices, I'm all for that. And, well, Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship is obviously open to more than just MMA fighters, because it's not MMA, it's Bare Knuckle Fighting. But more top-level MMA fighters and top-level boxers, for whatever reason, and we can get into that, needed to be KFC. I mean, the card that I did last weekend, you had Chad Mendez, who had 3 different title fights, 2 full, 1 interim, while he was in the UFC.
Right.
Who arguably is one of the biggest stars in all of combat sports right now, not even in his prime yet, still approaching his prime at 30 years old. Fighters continue to come in. Triad, which is a variation, you know, looking at the, as Triller said, leveling the playing field with boxers and MMA. And for some reason, going into that show, a lot of people were saying it was going to be a squash for the boxers, and just the opposite, actually. Team MMA won the 3 with the scoring system of 14 points to 11. It was a phenomenal night. So it's combat sports.
Except for Gigliotti.
Gigliotti
had a good time. Sorry to interrupt you there, but I had a little 6 degrees from separation from Gigliotti, because I did work with a guy that used to just do the video, who's now promoting a little bit, who went down there with the Gigliotti kid, and he became sort of a meme after the fact. This funny, catchy name, you know, that Fat Joe kept talking about and yelling out. That was funny, but it's an interesting format, I thought.
Yeah, and no, Harry, I mean, a great fight against Jacob Thrall. Thank you. You know, I really liked the format that was used. It was extremely fair. Again, the results show 4 wins to 3 for Team MMA. It did do, at least on that one small sample, that one card, left the field.
Yeah.
And I've seen that play out over the last 4.5 years in Bare Knuckle. The clinch changes the game.
Right.
Almost more so than if you allowing active clinch fighting changes the dynamic. That's why I think you've seen MMA fighters have more success than boxers when they're still an equal experience in bare knuckle. And I think largely that's what you saw play out. You know, take Mike Perry versus Michael Seals. I think Mike Perry would be the first person. He probably doesn't beat Michael Seals in boxing. Obviously, in MMA, that's a pretty easy win for Mike Perry. In triad, it was a very close decision win for Mike Perry.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah, and a great interview afterwards, too.
I'm a big Mike Perry. You know, we talked about that on the Bare Knuckle broadcast on Knucklemania last week, that there's the perception of Mike Perry, and then there's the reality of Mike Perry. And the reality is that he is a very bright, very self-aware, very witty individual.
Good point. And a good point about the clinch. You know, I remember Gracie in one of his early books talked about the importance of the clinch, like a third dimension that we seldom think about. You know, you're here in MMA, well, they're jumping around, but don't forget the clinch. So much goes on there. And this is a good point you said about that.
That's the differential. I mean, if you had allowed kicks without a clinch, you know, I think triad would have played out differently. Obviously, most boxers, you would have allowed a kick, like Chris Algieri, who came out of kickboxing, but most high-level boxers really don't understand fundamentals of kicks. But every fighter knows how to fight in a clinch. Everyone knows how to kick, but there are obviously different levels of proficiency of kicks. My buddy Ben Askren, for instance, was not a great kicker. But look at the clinch. Everyone in MMA knows how to fight in the clinch, and that's why it levels out. In Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship, there have been 4 legitimate major organization boxing world champions, and they've gone 1-3. And that really, to me, goes back to not fighting Bare Knuckle, but the fact that they're fighting with an active clinch.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, I got to ask a tough question. Do you own stock in Mountain Dew? What's the story behind that?
So the Mountain Dew. I'm hopelessly addicted to caffeine, and my caffeine delivery of choice is Diet Mountain Dew. I love it. In my real life, I'm a Mountain Dew person. Now, the difference between real life and being on television is, in real life, I try to limit my Diet Mountain Dew and my Diet Mountain Dew intake. Which, by the way, I try to limit it to the daytime hours. I'm not normally drinking in the evening for obvious reasons, because it's a lot of caffeine.
Yeah.
Years, and I mean for years and years, I have gone to shows and commentated with a 2-liter of Diet Mountain Dew. And, you know, people just see me on the air for years, but you have to think I might be at a venue 9 hours. So, yeah, it's still a lot of liquid to consume over 8 or 9 hours, but I'm drinking that over 8 or 9 hours. But I've done this for years, and people who've traveled with me internationally, be it China or Russia or Myanmar or Brazil, know that I will travel with Diet Mountain Dew in my checked luggage, because it's very difficult to find outside of the U.S. and Canada. But I'll have that drinking room temperature. It's great caffeine. It keeps my vocal cords moist. I just like having it. It's just part of my routine of being a fight commentator, live sports fight commentator.
So that's totally natural.
So a year ago in Knucklemania.
There's no arrangement with the company? You're not getting kickbacks for that? This is totally free?
I'm getting to that. I have some breaking news for you. I'm getting to that. But so a year ago at BKFC Knucklemania, the Paige Van Zandt debut card for Bare Knuckle, after the show, we're off air and I'm finishing off the 2-liter. So Phil Lambert, the great photographer, has a shot. I'm off air. I'm still sitting at the commentary table, and I'm literally tipping out of a 2-liter the last ounces of fluid in my Diet Mountain Dew. Takes a photo, puts it on Instagram. Our matchmaker for Bare Knuckle, Nate Shook, says to me, "Man, that was a really cool photo. How did they Photoshop in that bottle?" I'm like, "Nate, what are you talking about, dude? How long have we worked together?" He was like, "What do you mean?" I said, "You did not know that I drink a 2-liter of Diet Mountain Dew on every show." He said, "No." Never noticed. The very next week, I'm on UFC Fight Pass commentating Lion Fight Muay Thai. I take a photo of me with the Diet Mountain Dew side joke for one person, being Nate Shook, put it on Instagram. For whatever reason, it got a great response. So then I had to show the next week. I think I was doing a Roy Jones Jr. and take a photo of that, get a great response. A year later, it's become my thing. About 2 weeks ago, Mountain Dew actually reaches out, want to sponsor me. They get my information, so there you go. It was never the intention. You know, in good pro wrestling parlance, it's always been a shoot.
That's a great story, though.
I really drink it. Find me at any show. But if Mountain Dew wants to sponsor me, I am going to say thank you very much.
Well, that is awesome.
Patience.
Well, I think our biggest sponsor, as far as like name recognition, was the actual company that made Brondo from the movie. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie. Cult classic.
I think that's very cool. Hey, look, Brondo. If anybody wants to sponsor me, I am happy for that.
It was just as green as Mountain Dew, too.
Very cool.
It's a real energy drink. But, yeah, that's a great story. Getting back to the real fight stuff, though, what do you think about this whole Francis Ngannou thing? We talked a little bit about fighter pay and why they're doing these other things outside of MMA, but now the biggest story seems to be Francis Ngannou wanting to lock out his contract and fight Tyson Fury, of all people, in a mixed rules boxing match with MMA gloves on, is what they're describing it as. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, someone who got, aside from being a commentator, you know, I was appointed to the Kansas Athletic Commission in 2015. I'm the former chairman of the MMA Rules and Regs Committee. I'm not building my resume, just saying that I look at things also from a regulatory perspective. So when people start throwing out these types of fights, you always have to fall back to the commission. Now, if you try hard enough, you can get just about anything approved. I mean, look at the internet. You see some of the man versus woman. You see two-on-one. You see five-on-five.
Anything goes over there.
So there's a way to get, there's a way to get just about anything approved. With that being said, you know, Fury versus Ngannou, yeah, maybe. Mixed rules, it gets to be a slipperier slope. The bigger issue is contractual. But, you know, everything changed for MMA fighters when they saw Mayweather-McGregor and they saw the money that Conor McGregor made. The reality is, whether MMA fans like it or not, and first and foremost, I'm an MMA, is that there's a lot more money for Francis Ngannou to be made if he boxes Deontay Wilder or Tyson Fury or does some type of mixed rule with than in MMA, whether that's against Brock Lesnar, if that's against Jon Jones, if that's in an open weight match against Pierre, there's just more money there. Right. McGregor will never touch the money in his career fighting in the UFC or fighting anyone in MMA that he did on. The only way he would ever touch that type of money again is if he did a similarly themed boxing match. Maybe against the Canelo Alvarez, not that I'm making that match, but that would be it. So Francis Ngannou definitely took note of that. He's still under contract to the UFC. UFC has very restrictive contracts and enough to them, but those are the contracts the fighters sign. What happens to Ngannou is going to shape the industry. If he's able to get out of that contract, if he does a mega fight against Fury or Wilder, that changes the industry. If he's locked down to the UFC or he goes back to the UFC, the industry. You know, I'm never going to say anything bad against the UFC because they're the gold standard and everything drives through. What issue with fans do, and I certainly understand the point, is the distribution of revenue. When you look at the NFL, for instance, contractually, it's 50% to the owners, 50% to the players. The salary cap is adjusted every year based on the previous year's revenue. The salary cap for the 2021 season will be different than in 2021. It will be up or down based on the revenue from this immediate past season. In the UFC, I've seen reports that the distribution to the fighters is as little as 7%.
Yikes.
And wow. I was talking to, as I do every day, to the great Art Davey, right? The founder of the UFC, who I wrote Is This Legal with. And what Art and I were saying is that this is probably the only sport out in the world where fans say the fighters are underpaid. You know, no one's watching the NBA and saying, wow, these guys are underpaid. They're usually, why is the guy who gets 9 minutes a game making $18 million a season?
Exactly.
Or why is a quarterback who signed a $40 million contract, now second string for my NFL team. But when you look at fighters in the UFC who are fighting at 18,000 and 18,000 fight, fans take issue when they look at Francis Ngannou getting reported 600,000. So in an era where fans are anything but towards athlete pay, and fans are sympathetic towards UFC fighter athlete pay, that's something to look at. But believe me, it's not just the U.S. My former company, Bellator, you know, there are kids fighting on the prelims for $1,500 and $1,500. Wow. You know, PFL gives out their checks, which are cumulative, by the way. That's not $1 million to win that fight. I'm not sure if that's well known in the industry.
Right.
That's a rolling total $1 million. It's still a lot. But what about the kids who go 0-2 during that regular season? Right. You know, they're not making tons of money. So industry, it's an underpay problem.
Right.
When you look at house shows, obviously, if you go to a house show and the main event is getting 2,000 and 2,000% of the tickets he or she sold, fair enough, because there's not a lot of revenue. But when you start looking at companies like Bellator, like ONE Championship, UFC, it's a legitimate question to ask on fighter pay. I'm really proud of the fact that the two main companies who I commentate for, BKFC, Triller, pay real money to real fighters. You saw the comments of Mike Perry after Triller. You saw the comments of Chad Mendez and Paige VanZant after VK. They're dispersing that revenue. You know, you can't go broke. You can't give 90% of your revenue to fighter pay, or you're going to be like Affliction, who I commentated for last.
That's how I interviewed Donald Trump.
You know,
I got one question in on the
right,
conference call.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there you go. You know, I mean, was ridiculously overpaying. They overpaid me as a commentator. Everything was overpaid, which was fun, but it only lasted two shows. It's finding a, as I see it, like an NFL model, where you're contractually saying X percent goes back to the company and X percent goes to the people. That, I think, would make fans, or would certainly make fighters a lot happier.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, I've been involved with a battle with the UFC and went all the way to bankruptcy court. I spent 6 years fighting it as my own attorney. And it's all, I put a whole website together on it, sciencesucks.com. But
yep.
Now I'm involved.
Very familiar.
Now I'm involved in a site called paythefighters.com. And it's ironic because I kind of got inspired a little bit by Jake Paul, but also by a guy named John Scully, who does gets all kinds of memorabilia and auctions it off, and then it goes right to struggling fighters. Like Wilfredo Benitez there is one of the big ones. Wilfred Benitez. And the crazy thing is, I had an old Mike Tyson boxing glove that was signed, that I got signed in 2011 when I was out there in Vegas dealing with the Zions thing. So I gave it to John, and he auctioned it on Facebook and set a record for his page. I think they ended up getting $2,500 for a glove I only paid $300 for, because it was for charity, you know. And Wilfred's in bad shape. Like, he's probably not long for this world, but, I mean, it requires a lot to keep him in decent health, you know, and you know, good comfort. So,
and that's part of the industry that fans don't see.
Right.
Is that what will... 10 years, 20 years, 30 years after these guys stopped fighting, the vast majority of people don't think about that. You might think, oh, yeah, I remember that guy from 20 years ago. But you don't think about the lives that these people have to live in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond.
Right. So, you know, you got guys like Jake LaMotta. He's still kicking, running around. And, I mean, he seems to have no issues with... you know, pugilistic dementia just destroying him. But then there's other people that it catches up to really fast. And there's just all kinds of stuff going on with these fighters, like just starting out, that need help. So I kind of got together with...
Without a doubt. You know, if you...
Go ahead.
Go ahead, please. I'm sorry.
I got together with John. I did this project. It worked. And now I'm looking for a way to take it to the next level and make an interface where fighters can maybe sign up, and if somebody puts together a winning FanDuel or a DraftKings bet, or they put up a lineup and their MVP is a not well-known fighter and is not making a lot of money. They should be able to, with the sports gambling setup, I mean, it might be tough with regulations, but people should be able to tip a fighter. You know, he's an independent contractor for a reason, because they want to screw him. But there should be ways that we could work to pay them, you know, as consumers of all this. And we're making money off them, so why can't they get a little taste of that? But, I mean, there has to be a million ways we can think of to unite this community, since you can't have a real union. It never works. But to have more of like an association that stands up and does stuff for them and does events and charity auctions and works to give them a support system for situations like that. And I've started to look for like GoFundMes and stuff to highlight for people that have been in car accidents in the middle of training, and all sorts of things have happened. I mean, there's been fighters that have been killed in car accidents, just mowed down on the street. One guy from Bellator. You know, so you got to think his family was thinking of relying on him for his career. He was famous, and now they have nothing, and they're still mourning him. So there's just all kinds of ways.
Yeah, I know. Anything that you're doing, that anyone is doing, that benefits fighters. You know, as I said at the top of this interview, you know, first and foremost, I'm an advocate for fighters and anything that helps fighters. I think the average fan, not the hardcore, but the average fan would be shocked to learn how many active roster UFC and Bellator fighters have day jobs. Now, that day job might be being a full-time instructor at a gym, but the fact is they still have day jobs. They're still getting up and they're going to work, and they're using another means of income to support themselves and their families.
Right.
Like Major League Baseball back in the 60s.
That's exactly right.
70s. Yep. Yeah. It's hard to believe. And people hear that now. I mean, I was a kid back then, and you know, you'd hear these kind of occupations these guys would do in the off season. People have trouble believing that now. Now it's still going on. Very good.
Yeah,
point.
I mean, yeah. Even fighters ranked in season internal top 15 rankings, a number of them have jobs: teachers, firefighters, police officers, private security. It's amazing. Construction. It's amazing how many of them have full time jobs.
Yeah, it's crazy. Now, I got to ask, what do you think about this whole Jake Paul thing, where he has been really at Dana White's throat on the whole fighter pay issue, and then supposedly invested in Endeavor at the end of the whole thing? And now, I don't think he's actually been mentioned in a headline where he's been quoted on fighter pay for at least a week. But it's...
Jake Paul has a huge platform. I met him when I was one of the commentators on Triller on his fight, his trial versus my buddy Ben Askren. Much different from what I thought, but I've been in this business long enough to know that you need to know the person, like we were talking about earlier, and not to hype around that.
Right.
Jake Paul has gone from being relatively unknown to one of the most famous people in the United States.
Unreal,
in
isn't
half,
it?
Half years. He has a platform. It is. He has a platform. He has an agenda. Really? And he's pushing it through. What the end result is, remains to be seen, certainly. I know he's done some good things for some people, such as Amanda Serrano, which I very much applaud.
Yeah, she's actually somebody we've interviewed like three or four times over the years. And interestingly enough, I think it was the last time... She had a little side beef with Gina Carano. What's her name there? Ronda Rousey. Yeah, she wanted to make a point about Ronda Rousey the last time we got her on. It was kind of like, you know, something that just Ronda had said about women boxers or something like that, and she unleashed. So it's an interesting.
Interesting. I like Amanda a lot. I like her a lot.
With her and Jake Paul, and I love the idea of the $50,000 minimum per fight. I mean, that's a great idea. There's no reason the UFC can't do that. I just question, once anybody's involved financially with it, they usually go the company line, and that goes right down to the fighters. Sometimes they sign a big contract, they're usually gonna not talk out about fighter pay. Actually, Israel Adesanya has. He's just done that. He's signed a new contract, but has talked a little bit about it. But most people don't. So for Jake to really come out and keep doing it and keep talking about it, it's going to be difficult for him now that he's invested. And it might be a small percentage that's never going to be decision-making, but he's got a bottom line attached to it. So it's going to be interesting to see if he really pushes it from now on.
Yeah, you know, the whole issue with... Without a doubt, no, it'll be extremely interesting. And, you know, the difficult industry is that even if the UFC is paying what people perceive to be too small of an amount, it beats the alternative in about 95% of the cases. Right. You know, there are a small percentage of fighters
about
who go to PFL or Bellator or one championship. But
for that $50,000 bonus, no matter what it is, performance of the night, you know, submission of the night, whatever they're doing now, but... and you remember they had to change it. They couldn't call it the knockout of the night bonus anymore. You know, so it's been a different dynamic that's developed where now fighters are lobbying for it. They're, in the post-fight interview, they got to mention, you know, give me the bonus. So it shows you, you know, how important $50,000 is. If you started giving that as a base pay, I think you'd get a lot more interest in the UFC at a feeder level.
Yeah. And, you know, something else that's been talked about in the industry is no-cut contracts. That a series, one of the reasons why in UFC you see so many decisions and the number of finishes has continually gone down is because oftentimes fighters feel the need to lose rather than the fight to try to win. And they're two very different philosophies.
Right.
That if you sign a five-fight contract and you know that 0-2 probably sends you out of the promotion and you'll probably never make that type of money again as a professional fighter, maybe you're a little safe. Maybe you don't open up and fight to win and you're fighting not to lose. Whereas if you signed a five-fight contract and it was a guaranteed five-fight contract, it might change the dynamics.
Oh, definitely. I'm a big advocate of that whole put-on-a-show thing as being a little toxic at times for the UFC. You know, you got to put on a show to get up the ranks, to get advanced, to get that bonus. And so there's a lot of fighters that go out there taking too many risks. You know, when you know if they want a long career, they should fight smart. I mean, he's proud of it, but we had a guy on, Henry Corrales, who was talking about being happy that he was getting new teeth because he's such an aggressive fighter, and he puts his face out there. You know, and it's like, oh, more power to him for being, like, crazy and psyched to fight that much, but, you know, you still got to have defense, buddy. If you want a long career, you want to kind of shake
the guy. Without question. Without question.
But it happens a lot. I mean, these guys just are so encouraged to put themselves out there and put on a show and be exciting, and that means taking hits as well as giving them. And so it's just wild. It's a wild dynamic, and the UFC set the table for that, unfortunately. You know, just the way the fatigue is
right. Again, the UFC drives, by and large, in the MMA world. There are a few countries that are exceptions. You know, there are parts of Southeast Asia that are more attuned with one championship. There are parts of Central Asia that are more attuned with ACA. But by and large, the UFC sets the tone for the industry, from fighter pay to everything down.
All right. Now, getting back to what you do, just tell us a little bit about what your work life has been like. I'm surprised you have time to do this interview. I mean, you seem to be doing every show there is to do.
I've been really fortunate. I've been fortunate throughout my career and post-Bellator. I wasn't sure what was going to happen. One thing I knew I wanted to do was commentate boxing. When I was at Bellator, I was exclusive combat sports-wise. I couldn't commentate any other combat sport. So my primary gigs are Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship and Triller, and of course the news yesterday was announced that Triller purchased control AFC, which makes me extremely happy. I do a number of shows for UFC Fight Pass, including Fighting Chip, which is a really good Midwest MMA promotion out of Kansas City. I do a lot of shows on Fight TV. The thing I'm really proud of career, one of the few things I'm proud of in my career, is that I do Letway, Muay Thai, bare knuckle, boxing, MMA, grappling, and hybrids, anything in between. That, you know, I think of myself as an MMA guy, but I'm really a fight guy. I'm a combat sports guy.
Right.
And it's athletic competition involving striking or grappling. I love being there. I love being able to commentate that. And I like the fact that I can feel confident commentating submission grappling or light weight or anything in between.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, and like one of the things that I was most amazed by when I went back and listened to the last interview that we did with you, I could barely get a word in edgewise, Tom, but was to say, you never missed a beat. Like, it was just so natural flowing. Like, I can imagine that's just from a lifetime of working with a couple other people that you have to let get their opinion in and you get your opinion in. I mean, like, we never tried to, never ever stepped over each other if we could avoid it. And you guys just had a wonderful conversation of just nostalgic looking back at that first event. And, you know, like, I hadn't seen it like Tom had seen it. So I couldn't have that perspective. Because I just saw it in, like, a couple documentaries, and I got into it, like, literally the first big fight I paid for on pay-per-view was Chuck Liddell versus Rampage Jackson. So, like, Tom brought something to it that I couldn't bring, and, I mean, he came right out of his shell, and it was great.
In those days, and I know Sean will back me up on this, it was just, it was exciting. I mean, it was, to me, Tori. I mean, every one of these events was, it had a circus-like entertainment feel, but it also was an educational feel. Such a buzz. I mean, wow,
and,
what's
happening? You add to all the dynamic the fact that they were fighting multiple times in one night back then, and it seems impossible now. Seems impossible they could have
well,
done
that. Just the concept, that, yeah, and I appreciate your kind words on that, and, you know, just the concept of, you know, literally... that you weren't good at another technique, you didn't know another technique existed. For instance, in UFC 1, Ken Shamrock catches a Pat Smith in a heel hook. Wasn't it Pat Smith didn't know how to defend a heel hook, which he did not? He did not know that there was such a thing in the world as a heel hook. All he knew is his knee hurt a lot. And if you recall, he sits up and tries to throw elbows. He has no idea. It's literally something... that is happening to him. And as you'll recall, the with Pat Smith, that was his hometown, he'd won the Sabaki Challenge, which was their fisted karate tournament every year in 3 times. The fans' reaction to Ken Shamrock tapping Pat Smith on a heel hook is to boo. They didn't know what they had seen.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I equate it to, like, showing up at Wimbledon with a baseball bat and saying, who do I... I go. It was literally people flying in from different planets. They had no idea. Royce Gracie gets full mount on our gym, and unless he had had some schoolyard fights, he'd never been flat on his back with another man in that position. He had no idea. Everyone thought that their fight technique was the best, and everyone else's was horrible, and they were going to run through. The Gracies were the only ones who had any concept of cross training through the Gracie chat. Everyone else just worried about what they did. If you were a judo player, you played judo. If you were a boxer, you boxed. That was the reality of it. And that was the real beauty of UFC 1 and all of the early UFCs.
Well, and then you remember after UFC 4, when Dan Severn was running the table, and he was, I would say, the first wrestler. Just
he
really had his tech. You know, it was wrestling, his three techniques. But you remember, he was guillotined. He had to be told at the post-fight party that said, "Well, that was a guillotine shot." And he said, "Well, what's a triangle?" And then he says, "Why didn't someone tell me this 3 hours ago?"
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He knew he was losing oxygen, and his neck and his carotid were getting compressed, but he didn't understand the mechanics of why.
Oh yeah.
You know, this is a guy who was an NCAA Wrestling All-American, Division I at Arizona State. He was an Olympic wrestling alternate, and he had no conceptual awareness of a triangle. That shows you how much the world has changed in under 30 years with fighting. Greg Jackson said it best. Greg Jackson said he's had a PhD when the rest of us were in kindergarten, and that's really what the knowledge base was like. You knew what you knew, and you didn't know anything else. I remember watching a local show, there wasn't anything else.
And
I bet
$5 on this kid that was a friend of a friend, and I thought he was going to win the fight, and he got armbarred. And so I'm drinking at the after party, and of course I go up to the kid that lost the fight, and I go, I don't understand what's so painful about an armbar. So he goes, stick your finger out. And I stuck my index finger out straight, and he just bent it back real hard. Not enough to break it or anything, but I was, and he goes, does that hurt? And I go, yeah. Right. He's like, that's what an armbar is like. So I forever understood that that is painful and why people tap.
Exactly.
But, and it's just such a common move. I mean, you roll into it, and I've noticed that. It's like there's become a science behind, like, fooling somebody into thinking something else is coming and then slipping either, like, a armbar submission or the rear naked choke especially. Like, you got to be, like, maybe punching somebody in the side of the head, get them to put their hand up, and then you slip the other arm in. I mean, it's just like a whole science behind distracting people to slip those submissions on. And because so many people know what they are now, it's so much harder to get them. So it makes it interesting.
But, the evolution of MMA is that, you know, you might not be good at everything, you're aware of everything. You know how to do everything.
Right.
You know how to throw a head kick. You know how to put on a heel hook. You know how to hit a swoop butterfly. You know how to throw a 1-2. And that just was not the reality in MMA 25 years ago.
Right. Awesome. Well, tell everybody where they can find you online, Sean. I know I found you on Facebook.
So I'm on Facebook, Instagram with all my diet photos. It's Sean Wheelock Official. I'm on Twitter at Sean Wheelock, and I definitely am a very responsive people who direct message me. I will hit you back. I'm known to get people who reach out to free fight tickets. I do that quite a bit, actually. I just did that last week at Knucklemania. So I always love talking to fight fans. So Facebook, it's Sean Wheelock. Twitter, Instagram, hit me up. If you're around where I'm coming, and always happy to meet people, always happy to talk fights. And you know, a lot of people ask me about how they get into the business. I'm always happy to talk about.
Oh, Sean, one thing I wanted to mention for you. Back in the late 70s, I was just at the tail end of some time, stumbled onto a few crazy books by this guy, J. Camp Thomas. I don't know if that name is.
No, it does not.
Well, they're fairly entertaining books, and he had one about boxing's killer punches, and so I was, oh, okay, let's take a look at this. And after I watched the first tryout, it brought back memories of that, because what the punches were was he had the hammer punch, and then he had something called the baseball bat punch, where picture you're throwing a right hand, and... but then you stop and change the momentum and come back with the heel of your hand.
Interesting.
And then he was talking about if he'd have been training Foreman against Ali, he would have had Foreman come in with axe punches, hit Ali in the arms. And then his other was the guillotine punch. If someone's coming at you in a crowd, you hit him in the back of the neck. Now, here's the problem with that. All that stuff's illegal in boxing.
Right.
Boxing for Queensbury... if Foreman would have done that, he'd get a warning or two, and then he'd be disqualified. And as far as hammer punches, they are legal in MMA, but we see them on the ground more. We don't see them in the stand-up context as much as I would have thought early on, and maybe that's because of the times. But when I watched the first tryout, I said, you know, I wonder if there's something to this because of the clutch. And your great introduction when you had the two fighters and you were explaining what's legal and what's not. Great job on that one.
Thank you.
And that was kind of kicking some of this stuff into my head there, too. So may I get you a link for some? Now, these books are out of print now. And it's got fascinating stories in there. I don't know how true some of them are. But Maybe I can send you a link just to get your brain going on that.
I would love that. I would love that, absolutely.
Yeah, I'll forward the email address over to you, Tom.
What?
I got his email address through Facebook, so if it's all right with you, Sean, I'll forward his.
Yeah.
Forward your
email. Absolutely, okay. Please. No, anything with fight history technique, I would love to see that. No, that would be great.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, because his books, well, he had Boxing's Dirty Tricks. He had. It was originally How to Be a Super Boxer. Now it's Ass Whipping Boxer. And that one's free. You can find that one just to check it out, too, because he's a very entertaining writer. And the guy was an old man even back then, so he was probably born around 1900. You know?
Wow.
But some of this stuff, the way he set this stuff up with his stories, and then he had some kind of funny pictures in there, too. But I'm telling you, I was just, after the triad, I'm there on the heavy bag trying to get the power, because I always knew that baseball bat punch had power, but you could see it coming in a regular boxing situation, and you'd be disqualified. So this would be interesting. I'd like to see what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I would love to see that. I would love to see that. But guys, I so appreciate you having me on. Let's not wait another 6 years or 8 years or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to come on. It's a really entertaining show. Thank you.
Awesome.
Great questions.
We totally appreciate it.
We'll look forward to it.
We'll keep in touch for sure.
Thank you guys so much. I'm
going to
get to bed now and play dad, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
Awesome.
Have a great night, bud.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Good night. There we have it. Sean Wheelock, the man behind the Mountain Dew.